As everybody knows, this week we're starting Ruth. It's really neat because it's a little four-chapter book. It's unbelievably loaded with, you know, it's one of those things, it's one of the best illustrations of the Bible as a whole, in the sense that you can read it, it's a beautiful love story, it's really neat, and then, you know, you can peel off a layer and you can peel off another layer. So we're really in no hurry. So, or at least I'm not, so you guys can suffer with that. So, it's an interesting book at the time that it takes place, and because the book says, and I never really, when you're just reading through your Bible, sometimes if you're like me, you finish a book, you kind of close your mind and you move into the next book. Well, it took a while to realize that it says, in the book of Ruth, when it starts, we'll see in a minute, it says, and this happened in the time of the judges. So now that we've really thoroughly kind of looked at the time of the judges, we can look at this book and see, get a little more insight into, now we know what's going on in the background, in the country as a whole, politically, spiritually, you know, different ways that were things were going on. So, kind of one of the interesting things in the book I stumbled upon is the calendar plays a big role in the book, as we'll see, or at least I think it does. I mean, personally, anybody can step up. But what I started kind of looking in the Jewish calendar, and I never really thought anything about. I used to think, like you would say, well, September, it just means something different in Hebrew, and October means something different, and that's all it is. Well, not even close. Not even close. What I really found, as you'll see by the top of the illustration here, is the Hebrew month is based on the moon cycle, not the sun cycle. Which is kind of interesting that as mankind, as humans, we base ours on the opposite of what God based their calendar on. And so, what's really interesting, the time of the new moon, when there is no moon, is when their month begins. Found that a really, another little cool thing. Their day is based on, their hours are based on the amount of sunlight. So, I was talking to Mike this morning, you could have in the summer, if the sun came up at 5 and set at 9 o'clock at night, their day is still 12 hours long. So their hour is 90 minutes. So it's interesting when you start looking at things in the Bible, when you start saying it says, oh, and it was the sixth hour. You're like, why do people fight about the sixth hour? It's pretty plain. It's noon, right? Six to, you always thought it was sun up to sundown was 6 to 6 nominally. Well, that might not be true. Because if the sun came up at 5 and their hours are 90 minutes long, it might be 2 in the afternoon, not noon. So it starts to play a little more role. And again, you know, we don't have to delve into it. We're not trying to be Hebrew. But there's going to be some things in this book, and it won't go down into the hour part, I don't think. But it's going to be important that we stay into the, and that's what this little, so it's kind of interesting, the graph on the right kind of shows you how the Jews view their calendar. Is there's a time of deliverance, a time of separation, a time of revelation. There's exile, judgment, comfort, 40 days of Teshuva, atonement, season of joy, season of victory. So that's how their year progresses because they're an agricultural society. It's all based on the grain harvest and the times of the planting and when you do this. And it's really interesting. They had another one here I could have put up, but I was running out of space in a sense. That every seventh year, they add a 13th month. So on the, what was the seventh year? The, when you let the rain relax and, Sabbath week. You, that year of the Sabbath week, they actually added a 13th month. So, and that's what kept their count. Remember, they only have 360 days. So we have 365 and a quarter, pretty much, where we add a leap year and, you know, everybody goes through, you know, machinations of trying to keep. So, because if you had a straight 12-month calendar, never realized it just went. Eventually, the calendar would get, that's why the Gregorian calendar, but your planting season would move into fall, you know, instead of the harvest season, because the 5 days starts to make a difference over as the years stack. So God presented a way to fix the calendar to keep the planting season, the harvest season, and the festivals that they have play into those, you know, the when the Passover is. And for us, that's going to be the really, really big part of this, is when the Passover is and the Feast of Shavuot, which is the feast, we call it the Feast of Booths, and Pentecost. It's the 50 days after the resurrection is going to play a role in it. Because it's kind of interesting that it is the only feast that uses leavened bread. And that's going to become an important part of our story. And I say that. Everybody can say when I'm done this, they can say, Chris, you're an idiot.
To remember, you said it starts with they go by the moon cycle. But remember, their day started at night.
Right.
Evening and then morning.
Right.
That's how they could tell how long they changed the hour. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So it would start that night.
And it starts the month of Nisan. And what's really interesting is this is not the original calendar that God gave them. Post-exile, when they came out in Exodus, God changed their calendar. So the calendar pre-Exodus is kind of for everybody, and the calendar post-Exodus, there becomes a Hebrew calendar. So,
you know, what I thought was interesting when you're talking about the moon, telling you about the moon, because in Genesis, if you read Genesis 14, it says, and God said, when he created the whole universe, and God said, let there be light in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years. So I think that's interesting. He had a plan for those heavenly bodies to mark, and they, you know, those heavenly bodies. That was interesting.
Yep. So, and we don't do it so much now because we have light, we have electric, we have things like that. You got to figure in a. Oh, yeah. Except for this week. But, you know, they could, once, you know, the candles were out and everything, you were staring at a perfectly, you know, barring clouds, a perfectly clear sky, you know, and you were seeing, and the movement of the heavenly bodies became a big part. You can see it in, you know, all the cultures worship some heavenly bodies and stuff like that. So God made it a big part. So we'll come back to this as it starts to play a role. But if anybody wants to get really, really educated on this, feel free, and you can be the subject matter expert when we get to that little.
Where'd you get that chart?
Yeah,
I'd like to look at that at home, but I can't see it.
ChristianJewishCalendar.com or something. As you can see, the Jewish symbol has a cross in it on the right side there. So it's kind of, so what's neat about it, they kind of plant some Christian, like they, and we have the months, our months, the Gregorian months on the inside, so you can kind of see. They somewhat overlap, but not always. Sometimes it's exactly in between. So I'll get you that website. I'll show you what it is. But it's pretty interesting. And like I said, I found all kind of, like I said, who would have known that a minute or an hour wasn't necessarily 60 minutes because their day was based on the night. So the day was exactly 12 hours long, no matter how long the sun was up. So that's how they based their day.
I'm curious whether we could use that application in our lives. Like, do we actually, you know, like have like rhythms or something that we should pay attention to?
You can be the subject matter expert. We call it me, where I work.
That's interesting.
All right. So, little bit of background. The book is named after one of its main characters, a young Moabite woman. Would you think about the fact that I think it's only one of two books in the Bible named after women, and this woman is a Gentile. And actually from Moab, which is one of, God like calls them out for some specific, you know, chastisements because of, if anybody remembers, Moab came out of the incestuous relationship that Lot had with his daughters. And they ended up, although they're like cousins of the Jews, they ended up being like mortal enemies for the most part of both their existences. So, again, the book is set at the time of the Judges, a time characterized in the book of Judges of religious and moral degeneracy, national disunity, frequent foreign oppression. And it's kind of interesting that this book reflects there was a time between Israel and Moab, and it goes, there's a time in Judges, there's a time in 1 Samuel, and it's kind of interesting that even like us, there is like things going on in the world that our country gets involved in that we as people, I have no animosity towards the people my government is killing. That if I could meet them face to face, I would say, I am sorry. This is not how we feel or some people feel. And again, so you can see the disconnect between sometimes the dealings that governments have with each other, as opposed, and in this time it would be mostly kings, compared to the people could probably get along in a lot of cases, but it is what it is. And so this kind of delves down into one family. And in the book of Judges, we always kind of, we saw hints of families, but it was always usually in a bad light because it said, and his concubine, you know, and you knew that was the stumbling, that was going to be a bumble stumble. And so this kind of gets into a family, a specific family. And you can make the case that this family is, although, and you'll see, some people like judge them rather harshly, you could almost say they went on a missionary journey, in a sense, in a little, maybe it wasn't their planning, maybe it wasn't what they did, but it's what happened. So the author's unknown, some people believe it's Samuel, again, like the book of Judges, because David gets mentioned in the book, so you kind of think that it's, you know, it's obviously later in, you know, time that it gets written back. And and then some people can say the words that are used, that was written during the monarchy, so it would have been written in David's time by Samuel. I just giving you that information. I don't know if it's important, if it matters to us. So we'll kind of get into it. So chapter 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem and Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. Well, famine, kind of look it up, famine is one of the curses the Lord promised you if you did not keep his commandments and the land. He promised them they were going to go to a beautiful land, but if they didn't do this, famine was one of the things that could happen, the judgments could happen. And I just picked Deuteronomy 28, 23 and 24. It says, the heaven which is over your head shall be bronze, and the earth which is under you shall be iron. The Lord will make the rain of your land powder and dust. From heaven it shall come down on you until you are destroyed. So, you know, God takes this pretty serious. And I thought it's also Bethlehem of Judah. It points out, which is kind of interesting, because when in Matthew, when they come looking for the Messiah, they said, where is he? He says, he's in Bethlehem, Ephrathah, which is basically Bethlehem, because there's two Bethlehems in Israel. So you have to be specific as to which one, and all the way back in the Old Testament, God's making sure that you know this is the Bethlehem of Judah, because it's going to play a role in Matthew. So I thought it was kind of interesting to point it out here. All right, so the other thing is, going to verse 2. the man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephraimites from Bethlehem in Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. So, kind of interesting, Elimelech means God is my king. So, what's really interesting, the book of Judges ended on, and there was no king in Israel. But Elimelech's parents, evidently, knew who the real king was. So they named him. So this, to me, is kind of a hint, as we'll see, and I'll get into it later, as a hint of what's coming. Naomi means the pleasant one, which is kind of interesting because the land of Israel is spoken of itself. And God said, like in Numbers 14:7, and they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, the land which you have passed through to spy is an exceedingly good land, or pleasant, could be the other way. So the land was a pleasant land. If you guys grew up in the 70s in Baltimore, it was the land of pleasant living, right? So same basic kind of thing. And so I feel sorry for him. Mahlon means sick or sickly, and Chilion means pining or wasting away. So that was a really interesting name to give your kids to go through school with. I'll bet they weren't on the football team. So, but, you know, it always, you know, we have found out a lot of times the names play into the story, the storyline. So it's kind of that they went to live in Moab and lived there. So the guy that's name is God is my king is leaving the land of the promise and moving out. And some, you know, you can read, I would say 90% of people say this is a bad, it's a terrible thing, blah, blah. But there's many times in the Bible where people moved because there was famine. And many times God used it as part of his plan. So, I don't judge it. Again, when you see the outcome of this, it was like kind of God had it planned. But, you know, you can make a big deal about he left the land of the promise. But if you're starving, you got to do it. And then the other side of this is it seems like he might have been a person of wealth. So he might have sold his land and went to Moab because he would have been relatively well off in Moab with some money, some holdings that he left. So, and this gets into the interesting thing, other we've just talked about it, that the every 7 years all the debts were going to be forgiven. So even if you sold your land, it was really just a lease. You didn't turn over the title of your land permanently at any point. You basically sold it for 7 years, and in 7 years. Was it 749? That was 49. In the 49th year, all the debts were forgiven, and you were going to get your land back anyway. It was going to come back into your favor.
Hey, Chris, one thing, too, that you think about is the Moabites were the ones that Balaam taught how to get Israel distressed.
Yeah, well, that's going to play into the story here. So,
and it's
gone. No, that's fine. That's okay. You don't know what my thought pattern is. It's okay. Right. So they married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other named Ruth. And Orpah means gazelle or graceful, and Ruth means compassionate friend. So, again, to Scott's point, exactly what we're talking about. Evidently, they went and got the Moabite women were supposedly very attractive. Obviously, if that was what was used to make Israel stumble, and to think, you know, sickly and pining to get good wives, that had to have some money, right? You weren't going to go marry, you know. I'm assuming, you know, you weren't going to marry destitute, sickly, and fine, and think you're going to make out very good. So I'm assuming that's why I went back and assumed that he sold his land and he might have had some money when he went to Moab. And so they married Moabite women, Orpah and Ruth, and they lived there for about 10 years. So both Mahlon and Chilion died. And Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. well, I forgot to read verse 3. And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. So now they married two girls, and then they died. So she's kind of left destitute. So...
Now, verse 4 doesn't say that they were married for 10 years. It says that... after they had been there 10 years.
Right, he died. It does. Yeah, I don't know if they were married. I don't know if they just... Did they inherit their father's money is what made them attractive to Orpah and Ruth? I don't know. I think if God would have wanted you to know, he would have told you. So,
all three died within 10 years.
Yep, they all died within that 10 years that they were gone. And that plays into Scott brought up a point. You're not worried about it now.
That was just for you. Think about it.
You can look at it one thing. They left the land of promise to be prosperous. They weren't so prosperous when they left. After they left the land of promise,
right?
They were. So their reason for leaving. What was the cause?
I could make the case just like with Joseph. What you meant for evil,
yes,
God meant for good. So now we're going to get into an interesting part of the story. So when Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughter-in-law prepared to return from there. So obviously they're not doing so well in Moab. Didn't work out what they thought. Things are good back in Israel. So if I'm going to be destitute, I might as well be destitute among my own relatives. It's basically what's coming here. So with her two daughters, she left the place where she had been living and set out on a road that would take them back to the land of Judah. It's kind of interesting that this is going to be 70-some miles they're going to walk. And you go from an elevation of 4,300 some feet in the plains of Moab down to almost sea level and back up to like 3,700 feet. So, you know, unlike us that had to walk uphill both ways in the snow when we were kids to school, they got to go a long way down and a long way up over this 70-mile hike. And so Naomi said to her daughter, and you got to think how perilous. I mean, we constantly read, again, in the book of Judges, that people get robbed on the roads, and there was, you know, roving bands. You could get caught in the middle of a war. You could get caught. So this is going to be a very, very, we take it for granted. We just like, 70 miles, I'll just drive down to Richmond or whatever. Well, it wasn't going to be anything like that in these days. So Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husband and to me." So she mentions the Lord for the first time in this book. And so you can make the case that I think she has been a very, very godly woman throughout this. But she has obviously been an example that we're going to see that makes 50% of her daughter-in-laws want whatever it is that she has. So she's obviously kept her Jewishness, even though they were in a land of that was Jewish. And obviously her daughter-in-laws have been good to her, which I guess is that's what's meaning your dead husband's and me. That, you know, they didn't just run off and marry other men or whatever. They kind of helped her out and stayed around. So it says, "May the Lord," and again, Yahweh, "grant you that each of you find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept out loud. Obviously, for a woman in that day and age, the way you found rest was to marry somebody, and then you kind of had a household. You had protection. You had income. You know, hopefully you could have children. That somebody would take care of you when you got older, kind of thing. So that's basically what she's telling, "Hey, I hope that works out for you." And they're all just tore up that they're having to leave each other. And she said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why should you come with me? Am I going to have more sons who shall become your husband. So this is the point of the Levirate marriage, if anybody. So basically, it's kind of strange to us, but if you were a family and your brother died, you took his wife as your wife to where she could have children, A, to take care of her, and B, only men could inherit land at that time. So the way for the land in your family to get passed down was to make sure you had sons. So that was part of the Levirate marriage. That, so she's basically saying, you know, I don't know how Naomi is, let's just say she's 50. She's like, even if I was married right now and had a baby right now, by the time they're, you know, 20 years old and man marrying age, you'll be 20 years older. You know, you're not going to sit around here and wait for that. That's not going to happen. So she's saying, return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. And even though there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and gave birth to sons, would you wait around until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughter, it is more bitter for me than you because the Lord's hand is turned against me. So, again, she's basically saying, even if I had a son today, they just wouldn't, you can't sit around and wait the next 20 years of your most fertile and fruitful years to wait for my sons to grow up. So, especially after sickly and pining, we don't know what we're going to get. So,
funny note how she says the Lord's hand is against her.
Right. So she.
Who's guiding her home?
Right.
So she'll be better off in her old age with the Lord's guidance or following her husband to Moab.
Well, this is one of those things. I mean, again, how many times have we made decisions? And you've already made the decision. And you're praying to God. But you've made the decision. All you want Him is to bless your decision. So, you know, at this point, she's kind of blaming God, and you don't even know if God's been, obviously we know God's involved in this because of the outcome, but at this point, she's like, you know, it's God's fault, I'm in such, I've done things, but God's against me, it's His fault, I'm in this bad way, and I don't know about you, but I've been there, so it's not a good place to be. So, at this, they wept out loud again, women in a crying, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. It's kind of interesting, the word, if you look up the word, the Hebrew word for clung, in this, it means like glue. So she wasn't going anywhere. So Oprah is kind of, she's been good up to this point, and she's kind of held on, but she's able to be pried away. And Oprah, so she kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth said, look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people, and very importantly, and her gods. Go back with her. So I looked up the gods of Moab was Chemosh. And Chemosh was the national deity of the Moabites, and his name most likely meant destroyer, subduer, or fish god. So, I don't know why the land of Moab would have a fish god. You would kind of think that would be on the Mediterranean coast, but it is what it is. But what's kind of interesting is they did practice human sacrifice, which I don't know what that plays in that, but God has a very strong... It's kind of weird that all the deities that people would... We kind of... It's hard for us as humans. I know there's always... Like some people, you know, during war, can just their humanity can be stripped. But for the most part, we have built in some level of mercy, some level of, you know, live and let live kind of thing. And we don't understand that the deities set against us do not have, they are here to destroy you. Lock, stock, and barrel. Everything about you, they seek to destroy. No mercy. No mercy. They don't say, well, there ain't no sense in taking all these people with us. We've got our faith and we're just going to live. No. They're like, the more death and destruction we can bring, the better off we are for some reasons we can't fathom. So here's Ruth gets her big statement of faith. Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you will stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. And may Yahweh deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." So that is a pledge. That is taking an oath, you know, of everything. I'm sticking with you, thick, thin. Everything about you will become everything about me. And so this gives you the hint that Naomi has been faithful, like even for them to know about Yahweh, to feel like, but for her to make a pledge saying, "Your God is going to be my God. I'm getting rid of what I was, everything I've known all my life, what I was raised with, what my family did, everything. I'm leaving all that behind, and I'm done with you. I don't even know how your people will deal with me." You got to think, she's gone from a place where I'm sure maybe some things were kind of weird. But you got to think, the Jews had 613 laws to try to keep. That was going to be an interesting culture to try to migrate into. But she's saying, doesn't matter to me. Whatever it takes, I'm going with you. I'm with you. Which is a pretty interesting. And kind of interesting at this point, Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, so she stopped urging. So you don't know if she just got mad. You know, you could just see him walking along, not talking for a little while, or whatever. She's just like, "I'm going with you. You can do whatever you want." You know, and eventually she said, "Okay, I'm not going to say anything more about it." So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. Again, the house of bread is what Bethlehem means, the house of bread. So they left during a famine. Life gets pretty horrible where they are, and they come back to the house of bread. And I think it's interesting, when they arrived at Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the woman exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" So this is what makes you think that her husband was a pretty important guy when they left, because if you were like kind of a nobody and you just went to Moab for 10 years and come back and be like, "Hey, who's this guy?" But evidently they set the whole town kind of on fire, and it's like, wow, this is Naomi. She left, I'm assuming the point is she left is kind of important and rich, and she comes back with no husband, no sons, and a Moabite daughter-in-law. So you got to remember that's poo-pooed under the law. You were not supposed to have, and especially a Moabite. Again, God picked out the Moabites a lot of times. We could go through as we go through, and I'll find some verses. But he had some rather stringent words for them compared to just saying, "Don't marry the Gentiles." He was like, "Man, don't marry a Moabite." You know, it's kind of interesting when you go to, when you travel the world, and how people, you know, the racism thing in the United States and all, but I had a friend who was Chinese, and at work, and we were laughing about it. His parents were very traditional Chinese. They were like, "You can bring any girl home, but you do not bring a Japanese girl home, or we will disown you." They're still mad about the war. You know, so it's like kind of interesting how every culture has its, you know, people that they're not happy with. And you kind of find some of that in the Philippines a little bit. They're not really happy with the Japanese people are either. So interesting here, she says, "Can this be Naomi?" And she says, "Don't call me Naomi." So she told them, "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter." And Mara means bitter, and I found Exodus 15:23, and it says, when they came to Mara, they could not drink of the waters of Mara, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name was called Mara. Spelled a little different, but it has the same Jewish meaning. So she's like, "I went away happy. We left the land of promise, and it's just been a disaster for me. Now I come back and I'm bitter. And here she goes, I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? Why call me pleasant? I ain't very pleasant. The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. And again, you know, sometimes I don't know. Maybe God has. Maybe that was a part of the plan. Or you just made bad choices and now you're getting the results of those choices and you always want to blame it on God. I don't know. In your own lives, I don't know. You people are probably more perfect than I am. But I've made bad choices and things have happened. I blame it on God. So it just happened. So I don't know. She could be totally, maybe it's a mix of both. God knew what was going to happen, and he has pressed the finger a little bit to, like, get her back to where she should be, but her and her husband obviously made choices. So Naomi turned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. Again, falls back to the calendar. Barley was the first grain to be harvested, and it was considered the poor man's grain. Because it was first, it was used kind of as a sustainment, but it was the cheapest grain. Didn't sell for much, didn't make good food, all that kind of stuff. But it's kind of interesting. So that God gave us a little. It's kind of interesting. When God puts it, God could just say, they came back in the time of the harvest. But he points out that it's the barley harvest. So it's kind of interesting that he drops, whenever there's something weird there, he's dropping it for a reason. So there we are. So it worked out good. Any questions? Any disparaging remarks?
Gideon was seen as a barley rolling coming down the hill to destroy.
Right. So, and that's, we always talked about that, and the barley was the cheapest and the least appreciated grain. So, God went out. And that, so this gives you the hint that God wants you to know the calendar. God wants you to know kind of specifics about when this is, not necessarily the years, but when this is taking place according to the Jewish calendar. Anything else?
So when you always say, like, the name is the definition, are you sure that when they named them, they knew the definition, like, the, what they meant back in the day? Like, the sickly and weekly stuff, was that name maybe a, you know, just a name, like, you know, you know what I mean? Like,
well, I, you have to point out.
The definition of that word comes after the names of the sons.
I wasn't there. I mean, they called Esau Red, and he was obviously red and hairy and all the stuff that he was. So I don't know. But to most biblical scholars, they always point out that the name, and you're right, you would think, you know, I would have this kid, I would just call it for a couple of years, so I see some traits in his life that I can now give him a name that he's, you know, falling down or stumbling block or, you know, whatever. But I don't know. Or does the name bring about whatever it is? But you could say with, like, sickly and fine. Like, sickly. What if the kid came out and barely survived? Like, it came out, had jaundice, you know, yellow, all these things, and they're thinking, oh, this kid ain't going to make it, so we'll name it Sickly. And then he pulls through, and now he's saddled with, you know, Sickly the rest of his life. Or was he really just Sickly? I don't know.
Could there be, like, the name, and then because it was Sickly, now if he named it, not defined as that?
Egg and a chicken. Yeah, most scholars think that the name always plays a role in the, and I don't know. I couldn't tell you. That's just, it always plays a role in the story. When they got the name, I don't know.
Well, with the name, I cheated. I read ahead. Okay.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Illegal. Well, lag on the field.
It says,
do my scholars.
Also, the neighborhood women gave him a name. So, he gave him a name.
parents give him the name?
Or did the midwives?
Or did the tribe give him the name? Or did... But here it clearly says the neighborhood women gave the name.
So, I...
Who gives him the name?
He tried to name John something else.
No, you will name him John.
Well, one thing that's clear in the Old Testament is that when they named or when the father passed on blessing, it was real. Right?
Again, so...
When Israel passed on the blessing and pronounced certain things, it was real. Now, was it because God told you to those things? Or did he have a hand in that? It's a mystery.
And this, you can make the case that Samuel, if Samuel really is the author that wrote this, like I said, in the beginning we talked about it might have been written as late as the monarchy, because there's some mentions in here, and there's some text, the way it's written, they think it was written. So, you know, does the author taking a little liberty and naming the kids, or was this what was passed in? I don't know. Do you curse the kids by giving them this name, and then they're kind of, they live up to that name the rest of their lives? I don't know, but it plays a role in the story. I think it's just interesting that the last book ended and it says, and there was no king in Israel, and everybody did what they drank their own eyes. And then the first mention in the very next book says, there was Elimelech, which means God is my king. So somebody knew. Somebody knew who was supposed to be in charge, so I'm assuming his parents were, again, named him that out of righteousness, and then he kind of stumbled along the way and did something, but he was righteous enough at some point that his wife remained steadfast in her faith, and then brought back this Moabite woman by her witness. Like I said, you could actually make a case it's a missionary journey. So she goes to a foreign land and comes back with a prophet, with an apostle, or a disciple.
Okay, so
Samuel
is the
Gentile bride.
A Gentile bride, which we will discuss in a rather lengthy proportion. All right. Someone want to close this in prayer? Scott?
Sure. Father, we thank you, Lord, that...